one is they get mellow like whiskey, and that is like kind of
They get mellow like whiskey. One thing that might help is if we think it in.
If we don't do it in dialect, if we say mellow like whiskey, we may be fine.
Yes.
Because you can't understand it at all. So you sing it, it sounds great either by yourself, but when everybody sings it, it sounds like a mess.
They get mellow like whiskey. Instead of heard of. Heard of fiddles 400 years old. They get mellow like whiskey. Yeah, yes, that's right. No dialogue. They get mellow like whiskey.
It says they'll cost. Is that spoken?
I think it says they cost, but again, that's
well,
just like the other one.
Sung that says they cost really needs to be, because all you hear is 50, 60. You don't hear the bridge.
Says they. You know, the other one we have is, what's the first one?
Heard,
50,000. I mean, earlier we did one that we changed the tune.
Right. $2.
Jay much. Okay, that is right. That's it. Jay much of a fiddle, that becomes that. You know, instead of Jay much of a fiddle, Jay much of a fiddle, and says they cost. Okay, so it's the same tune.
Jay much of a fiddle, says they cost.
Okay. Let's do the top and see if that works. Fiddle is rare, hard, hard.
If you don't have to change it musically, we need to adapt to bring it up and out. That's
okay.
What I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah, in general, just talk the words.
Over, like really over enunciate. I mean like really geeky, because in that space it's just not gonna care unless we do it.
Yes, yes, okay.
$2. Heard of fiddles. Yeah, it's a transition from $2 into heard of fiddles 400 years old.
Okay. We're $2. Heard of.
We're losing heard of.
It was this. Now it's heard of.
Well, we got to hear the D in heard.
Heard of fiddles. Yes.
Heard of. Or heard of.
Heard
of. Yeah. All heard together,
of.
But it's
what for melody? Heard of fiddles.
Genius.
Pay $2 per up to 400 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. That Clancy Brothers technique.
Yeah.
Just needs a little bit of attack. Can we go back and do it again?
Yeah.
Don't you think
singing all of it.
Are we supposed to be singing with you on
not all of it. Not on the... You're supposed to be singing, layout.
Okay, so right now, this last time through, everybody was singing on the whole thing, which is wrong.
No, right. We're dropping out on big, deep strings of the guitar.
You drop, no one sings, only brother is singing E3, Brian can fill the guitar, and Michael's singing, and big strings of the guitar being like a heart, and everybody sings the rest.
So you all sing, play in the real, tap it on the tune. One, two, three, and layout. The harmonica's sharp chords, and the skirl and squeal of the fiddle. Is it and the skirl?
Yeah.
And the skirl and the squeal?
Right.
Two andes.
Can you
and
do
the skirl and the squeal?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, two
no,
guys.
No, it's and the skirl and squeal.
And the skirl and squeal.
Right.
Is it I'll rub up the bow or rub up the bow?
No, I think of it as rub up the bow.
Okay. Well, our attacks at the beginning of lines need to really be attacks, and
yeah.
We're not. That's why we're not that's why it can't be understood and it sounds sloppy.
Yeah.
Musically, I mean vocally, that's what they would tell you. It's just not a good vocal attack
yeah.
at the beginning of every sentence.
Okay.
And every word.
Rub up the bow with plenty of rosin. Rub up the bow with plenty of rosin. One, two, three, and rub up the bow with plenty of rosin. And it just fucking hurt on my. That's Frank. No, I think he might well be in the red.
Playing the real, tapping up a tune.
The harmonica's sharp chords and the skirling's feel of the tune.
Thank you.
suggestion. I think it's kind of good. Maybe a couple people could say pay $2 instead of like singing it, like,
you know, a couple of,
talk
you
know, it.
A couple other songs you did that.
Pay $2. Yeah, I thought of that as being talked as my energy.
So that the other people come right in with it. The herd of the herd of the.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Some people pay $2.
Pay $2.
Other folks
herd of fiddle.
I've been there this time. It gives me a great pleasure to say that. Well, it'll be a great pleasure to tell you, but rehearsal, we've run out of rehearsal hours for the thing. Steppenwolf has procured a large quantity of food and drink to sort of celebrate the end of our rehearsals at this space. And you are all now cordially invited to come down to the lobby and partake of this.
I was out there singing.
Kanye, man.
And then I left, so
I'm gonna have a card.
And
then we did Rosa, Sharon, Ma. We're gonna, Kanye and me have planned up what we're gonna do. And then we did Cherries and Apples. Just that narration there. And the music. Michael did the music for that.
And then Frank did some of your part.
Oh. I don't know that he did that. He didn't do that. Stop. No, he didn't.
I don't know.
Yeah,
what
he
your
said
part
this is how
is
I'd like to hear it.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, I guess the first question, the real general, and something is going to spark something or it's not. But I wonder if putting on something like this, I can see what the pitfalls must be. Certainly, it's more detailed. It's long. It's such a big cast. Was this particularly difficult to transfer onto stage from all of your points of view?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, it's enormously difficult. Well, and it's not was, it is. We're in the process of it, you know, so everything's changing right now. But, I mean, the book is 600 pages, you know, and they travel from across mountains and deserts and everything else. And there's so much of, obviously, a novel of that size and scope that you can't do on stage. There's no way. I mean, certain things you can do in film that you can't do on stage, and there are things that are in the film of The Grapes of Wrath that won't be on stage. But this is 1988, too, and it's time for a new adaptation, a new look at this, and I think the play is going to have its own set of gifts, just like the 1940s film had.
And there are things that the play can do that the film can't and is doing. They're focusing more, I think, on the family relationship than the film did.
It's also impossible not, I found it impossible the minute I read it, not to think about today and about what's gone on in 50 years. And I guess the homeless in the cities come to mind, as well as there's the farm problem, but that's only the sort of beginning. Basically, after thinking about that, I live in New York City, so you can't not think about it. You're really looking at it every 5 minutes. It's the way we treat each other, and that subject is, I'm talking about in the world, and it's what he was talking about, and it's, how can we not think about it? And
so you feel like
it's,
you're bringing...
It's on such a level that this piece is talking about that subject. I feel it, that it's on a level that we don't get to deal with all the time on the stage or talking to each other or whatever. So it's a I was about to say it's a treat, which is a very peculiar way to think about such a subject, but a privilege, maybe. Yeah.
Yvonne, what are some of the ways you think the play is doing, you said focusing on relationships, how does the play do that in ways that
well,
the film could?
I saw the film and I read the book and I'm doing the play and I'm really looking at Rose of Sharon, so I'm being sort of selfish about this, but what they did to Rose of Sharon in the film, did you guys see the film?
Yeah.
She was this ingenue and she didn't have any of the moments with anyone that
lines.
She has in the play. Yeah, she had about two lines, and they certainly didn't do the barn scene in the end, which is just sort of, I can't even think of the word, throw out a word.
No word, wordless.
It's the well, I to we. It's
the difference between being able to do it now and being able to what they were able to do then. They couldn't have been hard for them to do it as a play then. But just because of the restrictions and censorship and all those things that happened, that were happening.
But if they did it as a film now, that would take on a whole different moment, too, bearing the breast and suckling the man. I mean, so I think it works better in a play. And
what other things do you think the play does that the film did not? For one thing, that actually Cheryl might want to talk about is the way that you use the narration to bring out more of Steinbeck's own words.
I share narration responsibilities with Tom Irwin, and it's good for me because it transitions me from one scene to another sometimes, and it tells in a actually, we have to tell it in a few poignant lines what Steinbeck elaborated on in some wonderful pages. But it allows us to carry the audience, to carry the viewer along this epic journey, this odyssey with the family. What also this production allows us to do, which the film didn't, is explore the intricacies of some of the characters. Casey is really expanded on in this piece in a way that couldn't happen in the film, and he's so key that it's beautiful. And also, what I do see in this production that I definitely saw in the book is the beautiful relationship between two men, between Casey and Tom, and how that is a powerful bond. And through this individual pairing, I get, as a person, a deeper appreciation of the human bond. Because that's amplified in this production, I'm happy. I'm very happy. I like to see
human
beings. This is such an intense story, though. I could ask this after probably any Steppenwolf production of the past several years, but what is it like to be living this? And I think of that more in terms of how many people are involved in the cast, too. Even what Lois was saying already, it's such an intense story, and it seems to be hitting you all, you know, really close to home in a lot of ways. What are these weeks like?
They're getting longer.
But they're getting richer,
richer. We're absorbing more information, so you feel that much more exhausted at the end of each day, it seems.
That's true.
At the end of each day, I'm more tired than I was the last day.
I know. My body was aching today.
Whoa!
And you're also challenging your commitment, because when I go home, I feel like, I can't reduce these people, you know, but they have to still be people. That's the important thing, that they're just people and they're identifiable and they do things like the audience does, but you know, they're going through this thing that they can't help, and it's strange because they're so sort of heroic, but they don't know they're heroic, and you just want to make sure that they're given the attention and you embrace them as they deserve to be embraced. And because you have so much information from the book, you're bringing tons and tons of stuff to maybe one line.
Yeah.
Something that was a chapter in the book is now in one line, and you sort of feel a personal responsibility, even though you can't do it, and it's something in your own mind. But it's exhausting because, you know, you've got that chapter in your mind, and that chapter took you an hour to read because you kept going back and going, oh my gosh.
But you also spoke, about the number of us. I mean, that really is rare. We don't do that very often. Any of us actors in the theater have what are we, 44 people?
40? 41.
When
the
musicians
last count.
41.
44 with
41.
The musicians.
What's beautiful for me is that even when we do run-throughs and I may not be in a scene, I want to watch the rehearsal because there's so much going on. I want to be there. I want to witness. We have discussions amongst ourselves about what we saw or what we're now understanding that a person has brought to life on stage, and it sets off like a ping pong ball in a room full of mouse traps. It just sets all these connections together, and then you get charged and you want to do it again. I don't feel like, oh, I don't want to do a scene again. You know, I want to do it again.
Yeah.
And I read again when I go home.
Yeah.
Because as Ivana said, I feel a responsibility, not only to my character, but to all the other characters that people are investing so much of themselves and their commitment to. So
It's really fun to watch the play taking shape too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we started, I mean, we had so many things, and we've done a lot of playmaking in the last couple weeks, a lot in the last week.
Mm. In what sense do you mean
rehearsal?
That?
Well, you know, it's a brand new thing. It's never been done before. This this is a new adaptation, and it's brand new, and so it's up for grabs. Things come in, they go out, we change things, we put things in other places. You know, we're making a play as we're learning our characters and everything, and as Frank is shaping it, you know, we see that something doesn't work, or somebody will come in with something from the book that's like a really important thing that didn't necessarily make it into this draft of the adaptation that's been added now, and it makes a whole other thing happen. And so, you know, we're all like part of the playwriting process of this adaptation, which is really, you know, we always looked at making really doing a definitive stage adaptation of this play when we started 3 years ago. And we're all, these 41 people are all part of the playmaking process here. You know?
Is there an example that you remember of something that has changed drastically because of you all working together? I'm sure you have lots of examples. Maybe you can pick one. Someone brought something in like that, really turned things around, or...
I think everybody's brought in little ideas and stuff like that. I mean, there's 41 people there. There's a lot of brainwaves going. You know?
We did the transition from the burning out of Hooverville.
Yeah, what used to be there?
Nothing was. It ended with Tom saying,
oh,
we
no,
gotta get out.
No,
something
was
there.
There
was a song there.
There was a, okay.
We went into...
was it... Oh, there was a... Failure here, the topples, not that.
Cherries and Apples.
Yes, yeah, Cherries and Apples was there.
And it was just too mellow. No,
and
it's put someplace
else. Somewhere
else,
lost,
but now we have the transition of the
now
words.
There's
yeah.
pandemonium
there was
going.
There was an end of a camp scene where the cops said, we're going to come burn down the camp. And there used to just be, for the transition into the next scene, a guitar and some singing.
And oh, and there was the
Frank
harmonica
said,
interlude. That,
you know,
that came and went.
Right. That's the thing.
That's the one. And he said, that's not enough. We need the burning of the camp. We need the Bull Simple Man to be having his last things
and the terror
and looking
of
around
them
and
being
the lights
chased
and
from,
people.
Oh yeah.
The problem with the transition was that it was just, you know, we were coming out of this radical thing and we needed dramatic transitions
fire.
There, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
we went into a lyrical thing without any resolvement of the first
right,
thing into the next
right,
thing.
Right.
So
yeah.
Now it just turns into this chaotic.
And you know, yesterday we changed the end of a scene, that's the proprietor scene, where
right.
it ended on a sort of a so even almost a,
vague.
No, it wasn't a vague is the word, yeah. And somebody, Terry, came up with the idea of, well, but if we stick this in here and cut these lines and end it this way, now it's got an ending. It's
yeah.
That happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really part of a new play. I mean, we're making
yeah.
a play here. You know, it's a book that's been around for 50 years, but this is a new play. It's a new
but
play.
You know, these things couldn't happen unless Frank's adaptation was, there
yeah.
is such clarity.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
It has been, it's
yeah.
not like it's somewhere, maybe we're making it sound like there's this sort of vague outline and not a bit of it. There is such clarity and such... And such,
yeah.
And such, oh, here he comes.
So anyway.
So
here comes the writer.
No,
here's our writer and director. Yay!
Right.
Yeah.
We're just talking about you, huh?
We're speaking.
Did
just
you say Machera?
Speaking of
actually,
you.
One right there.
Okay.
Here, I just saw a little of that tape.
Oh, you saw
which
it.
Tape?
Just a little. Just
which
a little.
Tape?
Harlan County.
It is something to see, the whole thing.
Harlan County? Oh, yeah. It's
I didn't
really.
Get to see
it. I've seen it twice.
I've seen it twice, too, and
so
I want to
so
see
sad.
It again.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff they captured, like the guy, the drive-by shooting, you know.
Well, I didn't see that. I just saw the film. I'm going to see the whole thing.
What I remember most is that straightforward thing of those people. It's inspiring because that's why I want to see it again.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. Very sad. Very sad.
Oh, thanks, doll.
Well, I wondered what you all thought. I mean, you all come from different places, I suppose, or many of you. What you all thought when you first either heard that this was to be adapted or saw the script. This leaves you out, but everybody.
It's fine. Put me out.
But I wondered, you know, was your first thought that this is something that can really come together? Were you overwhelmed by it, or what did you think about the concept?
Before we've been cast.
Before. And then after, you can answer both ways.
I can't respond.
I was knocked out. I read it, and fairly near the time of rehearsal, I came into it very late, and I read this thing, and. Well, actually, I got it in the mail. It came on Friday, and I was doing a play in New York, and I had a 5 and a 9 performance on Saturday. But I was very busy, but that was the time I had to read it. And I got up Saturday morning and opened it, and I tell you, by 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon when I had to go to work, I was like a... I was really wiped out. That's what happened to me.
I didn't stop reading it after I picked it up. Because I was seized by some of the power, and I could see because of the writing and the reverence for the text. I could see the text whole and unviolated, and I could see the power that it was going to have dramatically. I could visualize just from the stage directions and some things what it was probably going to be.
Okay, is she close enough now, or we should go back in the corner? Okay. Then the next question is for Frank. What made you think this was a good idea to adapt it, and how did you get the rights and all
that? Gary made me think it was a good idea to adapt it, because he said when we had initial conversations about what we might do together in the future, when he asked me that question, what would you like to do with Steppenwolf, I thought about it for a couple of days, but The Grapes of Wrath was something that was a way down the road idea for a possible stage adaptation, and I mentioned it to him, and I can still remember his face when I said The Grapes of Wrath, because Steppenwolf had done Of Mice and Men, and very successfully, and it was a very important and very, you know, moving experience for the ensemble, I think. And the opportunities for the actors, as well as the challenge for the whole company in terms of telling the story, was something that, you know, was an impossible concept, but still sort of a dream. So we then, you know, pursued it.
Didn't hesitate for a second.
Well, he didn't hesitate for a second.
So you really did it yourself, is that right? You get all the credit for the actual adaptation.
No, well, it's something that has emerged in the work of the whole ensemble. I mean, shaping it and finding its architecture and finding its points of light and darkness is something that you do with the whole group.
I was saying before you came in, if it hadn't been for the clarity and strength and structure of what you've made, that kind of thing within 4 weeks, three now, that could not have been possible if you hadn't brought us.
If the base.
If you hadn't brought
so
us
solid,
the,
yeah.
this, yeah, right.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
What were the biggest obstacles? And I suppose the length of the book versus the length of the play must have been one.
And you should hold that thought while I flip the table.
Oh, all right.
But you only had one cigarette, otherwise I'd have been puffing by now.
Well,
I've got some downstairs.
No, that's all right.
Okay, are you ready? I'm just asking about the obstacles.
Yeah, the obstacles. Well... Yeah, the length, I suppose, is a part of it. But in a way, the novel helps us as stage artists, as theater artists, to find its drama, because the drama is there in the novel. The novel has, because of its form, an opportunity to be more leisurely in the way the story is told, to play values, to focus on details, not to hurry, not to rush. Steinbeck, in his journal, which he kept during the composition of the novel, was always reminding himself not to rush, not to hurry, to focus on details, not to be impatient. He knew the story before he started telling it, not only because he was so familiar with the real migrant families who came to California at the time that he was living there, at the time that he was writing articles and developed a government pamphlet about the plight of the migrant workers, but he somehow had the design of the book in his head, including the very last scene, before he began writing. So he persisted in reminding himself of how important it was to focus on details and not to rush. Well, the difference between the panorama of the novel and the more condensed and epitomized, not in the sense of better, but in the sense of shortened version of the story on stage, is a matter of, you know, sort of finding that spine and fleshing it out only with what's there in the text. There are many, many side trips, and there are abundant riches elsewhere in the book, lots of other characters, of course, and things that we've had to do without. But I think that the form of the play that we have is the form of the novel with other details removed. I mean, we haven't applied a dramatic structure to the novel. We found the crisis point and the climax, and we've let the action of our play hove to those critical points, so that the obstacles are many, but a way of overcoming them, I guess, is to just persist in a deep reading of the book, you know, and we've all done that, and to try to shed light on its essence, you know, I guess, if that's a way of putting it, mm-hmm. rather than just cutting away and carving away. I mean, you find what's there that's sort of at the core of it, and then it becomes clear what the priorities are. I mean, what you can do without, because you know that this is something that you can't do without.
Mm-hmm. And going at, you know, realizing that it's a play and not a film was an important thing.
Yes.
You know, once,
yes.
You know, you think, well, gosh, you know, we got to have this scene and that scene and blah, blah, blah. But the way you've structured it now as a play, it's a theater piece.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yes.
taken, you know, the realism of a film was
a lot of
cast
highway
away.
Scene.
Yes,
and
that's
and
right.
Stuff.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Also, one thing that Frank did that I thought, and I appreciate as an actress, and he was so sensitive to it, was the journey of each character. And it's incredible. All of us get to go through a journey, and like there are a lot of roles that could be just small roles, you know, all so-and-so's in the play, Noah, so we have to stick them in there and give them a funny line. But everyone gets to go through something and gets to expose their worst fear and gets to come out of it a little better person, and every main character has a journey, and it just parallels with the journey. It's a journey of the human spirit, as Frank Estet said, and it's just so wonderful to be able to have that, because that's the first thing I look for in a play is, you know, where's the journey for the character, and it's totally there for everyone. It's just, oh. It's
well, and it's there because it's there in the book. I mean,
yeah, but,
it's each one
like
has
that.
his arc or her arc, and there's a course of there's a story for each of the characters, and it's critical if they're going to be there for that story to be told in each case.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that makes the. I think we're all a little bit stunned.
Mm. Yeah.
I know I am, by the mystery and the size of the story. I mean, it's life changing in a way. I mean, it's a privilege to have the experience. I mean, so many people have been touched by this novel. We're right now in the quick of living it. You know, and it's a privilege because we've learned so much about ourselves, as well as about the novel, about what it is to be human, what it is to love, what it is truly to sacrifice oneself, what it is to be in need and to give. And that is exactly what happens to the Joads. I mean, they are pushed to the absolute limit of human endurance, withered to the point of being close to extinction. And when they are desperately in need, they give. They are
they are burned bright by the journey that they've been on, and as a result, they have a kind of almost mystical generosity. I mean, I don't mean to be too high flown about it, but it's because it's on human terms, it's very, very simple. But we forget in the sort of murky complexities of modern life and all of the issues that distract us from the bone truth of what it is to meet another human being and truly have a sense of the other, especially when the other is a stranger. You know, to be able to just give in to the other and to give to the other. I think it's that strain of gold, of truth in the novel that has made it sort of, you know, universal and a great work of art.
But it's also so fearful. It's not just noble, it's scary as hell. And it is now, and it was then, I'm sure. And you can't help thinking of the new ways that the edges are scary of existence.
Yes.
We keep making parallels between what we see revealed in the text of the film, the book, and the play, and what we see in contemporary society. And to get true to our characters, we often have discussions about what a character is doing and where he or she is going and why, and that's colored by our personal experiences and convictions and our gropings and wonderings. And so as an artist and as a human, I know I'm stretched and challenged. And so it goes deeper than just remembering my lines. I'm remembering where I am and where that person is. I mean, I know that we were in a part in the play today in rehearsal, and I was crying, which mm-hmm. was me, because there was a death. There are many, but this was a loss of a child, and children are wealth. And it just caught me at an off moment where I was supposed to be paying attention anyway, and I was supposed to be another character. My character isn't crying. But it touched me as a person, and that's where that came from, you know. And that'll happen. You'll be, as I said, we stay in rehearsal, and we're watching, and 40 people watching you turns into almost like a little house, you know, a little theater. And it's not that, normally you'd have people who are in the play watching the rehearsal, but then when 40 are there, you've got a whole bunch of people, but we're all sitting there because we can stand to go through it again.
You struggle not to cry sometimes because you're on stage and you're watching it, and Frank's, like, they're not sentimental, they're real people, and, you know,
and you know it's going to happen. You know you've seen it.
You know
it's going to
happen. That's the ridiculous thing about it, because you're like,
just like every time you read the book, you can cry at the end. You know,
you can.
I mean, it's just or the beginning,
you can cry
or the middle,
other places too.
Or the,
when Casey
you know,
dies,
I mean, every place. There's so many devastating things about it, and it's so universal, really. You know, I mean, poverty is so universal.
The kids with the candy cane and the truck driver and the mm-hmm. waitress.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that making it harder for you in some sense? Because it's not like some long-standing production, like you were saying, that's already done and you know what to expect out of it and you put it on stage, and certainly you get involved in it, but you at least know better what's ahead and what it's going to be, and this is something that you're all sort of experiencing.
I'm just discovering it, you know. I mean, every day you discover it.
Yeah.
You know, you discover something else, and Frank will talk, and as he's talking, he'll say these great things to us, and I'm sure he's discovering it while he's saying
yes,
it. You know,
true.
I mean,
it's
we're
true.
All just, you know, things just start making more sense, and then they get more complicated.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then you're embarrassed that
they get clearer, and then they
get because
more
it's so obvious.
Yeah.
And then you say, "Oh my God, I got instead of 10 notes, I got 110 now." I mean, after we just talked, now look at this note and that note and that. But you trust Frank that his insight married with yours will be honest every moment.
Well, it's also true for me. I mean, what you say about just sort of my not knowing what I'm going to say is really, really true. It's like, you know, you reach a stage in a collaboration with other artists where the discourse about the work is the work. And it really is a discourse. It really is a dialogue. Because I am so filled with the work of these extraordinary artists, I have something to respond to that takes me to another level. So I see what happens in a scene because I'm really seeing it. I mean, I'm privileged to be able to see it, and that helps me see it more clearly, or hopefully, or even maybe I don't see it clearly, but I have a question about it, and if I have a question about it, then, you know, the discourse continues. So it's a constant exchange about the thing that we're experiencing together, and that's what makes it rich for us in the making of it, and then ultimately in the execution or the performance of it.
God,
I mean,
do you have an
God
example?
God willing.
Do you have an example of a scene that struck you that way? Some, you know, something, share something from the rehearsal this past week or something that.
One of the things you were saying yesterday, I mean, it just blew my mind when we started talking. When we were talking about some scene and we got into like the war, talking about war, and there must have been some beautiful days.
Yes.
Said, I mean, there must have been beautiful days in the concentration camps, you know, when the sun was shining and the sky was blue.
When we were all on stage, everybody wasn't just all beaten down when we were 66. Doing something. 66, right, we were going cross stage, and you said, well, there's an energy, there's a way to get across the stage, and we're not just walking across in time to the music.
Yes.
There's a center that we have to have.
And then it triggered something in your funny little head that made you go into this whole thing that blew all our minds yesterday. You know, there was this dead silence, you know, where everybody just, like, their hearts dropped down because he said this great thing about war and, like, comparing the concentration camps and a beautiful day, you know. And it just...
Well, when you watch something that is an illusion becoming true. You know, when you watch actors who are finding in themselves the truth, you have insights about, you know, I mean, you do. We all do. We are all watching each other work, and ideas occur or images come up about the paradox of you know, the human drama, that is to say that it's full of ambiguities and contradictions and confusions, and that one of the, I mean, we weren't really talking about this quite yesterday, but one of the things that is an element in the novel is the contrast between the tragedy of the Jodes, you know, constant battle against the losses that they suffer, and the fact that there are lots of other people in the world, in the historical world that they're traveling through, who are very, very comfortable and absolutely fine. Who were, I mean, it was a difficult period, but this wasn't a kind of national. The family is not a national family. There's a strong contrast in the novel between the haves and the have-nots. The scene in the diner with May and the truck drivers and others, when the dream of Rosa Sharn and Connie is put in relief because they're driving through town and there are dime stores and people chewing gum and people who can smoke and people who can eat, and those shocking opposites, because the play is about them, are always producing links for us into a world which might otherwise seem a little bit distant. I mean, these people are just around the corner. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, when I first read this book and felt that when I got to the end of it, I mean, we all experienced the end of the book at one time for the first time. And I think you're right that you can get that back every time you read it in one form or another because you just go through it again. But now, when you read it, you have to realize that although there's something mythic about the profoundly generous gesture of Rosa Sharon at the end of the story, of her giving of her useless milk because the baby has died to a stranger. But those people, that action of generosity is not very far from this theater. It's just around the corner. I mean, there are people who are just not far from here who are in terrible, terrible trouble. And it can be a beautiful day, or it can be, you know, a heat wave, or, you know, when something happens to you that's disastrous, you often focus on the tiny little, you know, the pulse in your vein. Can I still be breathing that this has happened? You know, can I still be holding a cup and smoking a cigarette? I mean, is it still 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, and you're in the grip of a terrible, terrible trauma. And the most mundane things suddenly ring and you remember them, like the weather or some other silly domestic detail, you know.
I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the techniques you use to bring this to stage. The narration we talked about a little bit before you came, the music. Tell me how those things work.
Well, from the very first time that Gary and I talked about doing this, it seemed important to do two things. One, to somehow preserve the unique structure of the novel, the alternating chapters of specifically following the Joads and then moving into a more general panorama that connected the Joads to a larger condition. And we really felt that, you know, in some ways the novel is kind of like a ballad with alternating stanzas, and it has a kind of breathing rhythm. And it, that has a gathering effect on the reader. The fact that you come to the end of a specific chapter about the Joads, and then you have a landscape, and it may be just two or three pages, but it gives you an opportunity to sort of reflect upon and deepen the experience that you've had in the specific chapter while you're looking over the whole course of the issues. So I really believe that one of the reasons why the book is a masterpiece is because the alternating chapters produce an almost unconscious sort of hypnotic breathing relationship between the reader and the story, which if those general chapters were cut out, you'd have a kind of trajectory in terms of the story of the Joads, but I don't think you'd have the same kind of emotional force and impact. And we wanted to preserve that, but not preserve it in a way that the audience, as an audience in a theater, would become, you know, hypnotized by the regularity of the rhythm. Scene, song, with the same kind of metrical balance.
It really sneaks up on you.
So we wanted to always change it, mm-hmm. and to use the music and to make the hinges and to use the concept of the male and female narrators, to use narration sparingly, to create the sense that all of the members of the ensemble, including the Joads, were telling the story, mm-hmm. so that we could, as I say, preserve this rather unique form of the novel and at the same time surprise the audience in the way that they need to be surprised theatrically, because that's why you come to the theater, to be astonished.
And also the words for the songs are Steinbeck's words, so you
right.
have a way to kind of condense more of the novel in there that we wouldn't otherwise get.
Yes. And some of those chapters that we have used in the lyrical passages that are set to music are chapters that actually do sing. I mean, you get the sense that Steinbeck is introducing voice by voice by voice by voice a whole chorus of American individuals, of American voices, and that those voices aspire, sometimes in the course of the book, they aspire to song. So we've just given them song.
The car salesman,
yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
And there's a song for him?
Well, there are several car salesmen who...
That's a wonderful
job. Who's saying, yeah.
I wonder if we got one, did we?
No, we didn't do
so.
The car set.
We
that
so
involves six people,
after.
So we didn't do
it. Oh, okay.
It's a whole little scene, and oh, it's great, and the truck comes on at the end.
But it's tied
and
into
it goes
the Joads
buying, right,
their
buying
truck,
their
which
truck.
It wasn't. It was done different in the book.
It's different in the book, yes.
Yeah, but it's real nice the way that's been married.
It's very funny to me. Very funny.
Okay. Are there other things like that that tie it together that I have not yet been made aware of?
Well, it's we're just at the brink of the actual experience of the tech of the process. So there are lots of elements that are mainly visual and acoustic that we haven't really experienced yet, that we haven't really gotten into yet, but they also contribute to the sense of the way in which the story is told, the convention of telling the story, lighting, for instance, the way in which lighting is going to help us compress telescope space and time, because we have obviously a problem in terms of the duration of the telling of the story and the duration of the actual story. They're not the same duration. So we've always got to be folding time and stretching time and playing with time and with landscape in order to get it all in. But that gives the telling of the story a real interesting variety, an interesting rhythm of its own.
You're also deeply immersed in this, and it's struck you in such a profound way. Have you thought about what the audience will be like? What's going to happen to the audience, do you suppose?
That's their business. We make the gift, hopefully give it. Yes. I hope they receive it.
Yeah. I want to drop them to their knees. I want them to crawl out of there.
When we were rehearsing one night, I just looked at the last scene. It was one day we were doing this gift. And it was silent. It always is silent when we get to the end.
Well, they're waiting for me to take off my clothes.
No, but not that, because I'm listening.
And I'm not a gunner.
No, but you're on stage, and you have a different antenna working. But it's always this hush and this quiet when it gets to that point. And I remember thinking one day, I bet the audience is going to be just sitting there like hammered sheep, like, I have seen shows where the ending is so cataclysmic that the audience can't move for a minute. There's a minute when they just have to get themselves together to respond, and the clapping is kind of pattered a little bit, and then it swells. But I know, I feel in my heart that people are going to have to just catch their breath, because we do in rehearsal sometimes.
Yeah, we do. If we do our job, yeah, it'll be like you read the novel, you know? You read the novel and you put it down and you're just stunned.
You don't have anything to say.
You just can't talk.
I remember the second time I read this novel.
Right after we decided we were going to go ahead with it, reread it again, and hadn't read it since high school, and I read it. Was on my way home on British Airways from London after working on Orphans. I finished the book, and I just started to weep, and I was stunned again, you know. And I knew what was coming, but it grabbed me. And right at that moment, the pilot decides that he's going to walk down the aisle and see how everybody's doing.
Oh, you know? No.
And I put the thing down, and here comes this British Airways pilot. Hello, good evening. How are you this evening? And I'm like, I'm great. I'm great. You know, I'm weeping and sobbing, and I'm telling him I'm great. You know, and just as I finished, he came up to me. But it's staggering, you know. If we do our job, the audience will be stunned. It's like when you read the book, you're stunned by it. And
I feel naked. That's the only way I can explain it, and I don't know how else to say it, but I feel exposed. And I remember finishing the book, kind of looking around to see. I can't remember if people were around, but I remember looking around because I felt vulnerable. Because Steinbeck had taken me to a place I wasn't expecting to go, and whang, I turned around and I was just no artifice, no nothing.
Yeah.
I was facing two people facing themselves in honesty, and I was witnessing that,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
It's like watching, I don't know, walking up on two people making love or something. It's just, whoa, what did I see? And just keeping quiet about it for a minute and witnessing it.
Did you have any trouble getting the rights to do this, and had others not tried, or?
No, it's been attempted before. They never wanted to sanction a really legitimate professional first-class production of an adaptation of the book.
The estate.
Yeah, the estate, yeah. And but when we approached them, they were receptive immediately to the idea. We really didn't have trouble getting the negotiation going at all. And they were really receptive right away, right off the bat.
Do you know what the difference was?
Well, they knew Steppenwolf, they knew our work, and Mrs. Steinbeck had seen...
She'd seen some shows in New York, and they just felt that, you know, I mean, I don't think that they weren't, you know, I think it was, I mean, it seems to me that in the back of their minds they were hoping or, you know, someday something would be done with it theatrically,
mm-hmm.
but they did not want to enter into the right situation, but this situation presented itself to them, and Steppenwolf at the time, at that time 3 years ago, was a very, you know, it was in the media all the time, in the national media all the time then for the work that we were doing at that time, and they had seen a lot of our work in New York, and I think it just the combination, mm-hmm. the timing that mm-hmm. went into, you know, us going after the rights right at that particular time, it just, you know, kind of happened very naturally, and they were very receptive right off the bat.
So Mrs. Steinbeck is still living, apparently.
Oh, yes.
Is she going to see this?
Yes, yeah, she is, and she's been to Chicago, and we met with her. And
she won't be here opening night?
Yes.
She'll be here opening night.
Okay. I don't
know
what
she's doing. Staggering out of the. She'll be crawling out of the.
With the rest
of
the one on these.
Out of contact.
I guess I don't know that much about Samick. Does he have children also, Emma?
Yes, and he has two sons that are still living.
Okay. I think we covered everything that I had in mind. Is there something that anybody wanted to say that we did not? Did anything specific about your characters as you were putting them together, and as you still are, I guess, anything in particular that was difficult to bring them to stage beyond what we've been talking about the content of the story itself?
I haven't finished doing that yet.
Yeah, still. Frank put it all in there, though. I mean, the most important things that each character has to say is right in there. It's up to us to do the job, but he provided it. I mean, I assume I'm speaking for more than just myself, but it's all there. It's just a matter of can we do it justice, I guess. But it's there for us.
I guess for people who don't perform, a character for me personally is always developing, it's always coming to life, and every performance is an opportunity to breathe more life into that richness. And so I'm not ever going to tell you I'm through, because I'm not ever going to really be through. I'm going to make major accomplishments, hopefully, but she's always going to be coming along, you know, until the last show. Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say that the last performance will be much better than the first. It's going to be richer for me, and hopefully for the audience. It's still going to be good. I'm going to find so many more things. I know I'm going to.
Like Frank and Lois both said, they both mentioned this particular word in their description of what it's like to be in this particular play. I remember when I played George in Mice and Men, I felt the same way. It is a privilege to work on the material. It's like sacred to work on this material, and you don't get the opportunity to work on this kind of material very often. It comes around once every 10 years, you know, 5 years, or whatever it is. Playing Tom Joad is the same thing for me as that I felt with Mice and Men, except on a more epic scale, because it's a bigger thing, it's a bigger challenge, and it's a privilege to try and do justice to or to be able to have the opportunity to attempt to do justice to the words and to the this